Of Mooney Goes Wild at home, for the moment at any rate, because next Sunday Mooney Goes Wild live on RT Radio 1 from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. So please make a note in your diary. We're moving to the studio from next Sunday for the summer months, but do not fear, because right here on Monday nights we'll be giving you a second chance to hear some of our featured documentaries from the last quarter of a century. As you know, Mooney Goes Wild is celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1 this year. So next Sunday we'll be live on Radio 1. We want to hear from you. All you got to do is email mooney@rte.ie with your questions, your videos, whatever the case may be. We've been doing it for 25 years. You know how it works. We'll do our best to respond to every email that comes in. We'll give you all the details again next Sunday live on RTE Radio 1 from 6 p.m. But right now I'm at home in South Dublin. Richard Collins is in North Dublin in Malahide, and Niall Hatch is in Greystones in County Wicklow. Hello, Niall.
Hi, Derek. Hi, Richard. How are you both doing?
Hello, Niall. Everything fine at this end as well. I think you've got rain down there, but none up here.
Yeah, it's threatening. There's a couple of drops just a few minutes ago, but so far they're holding off. So hopefully I won't get too soaked here in the garden. It's a nice day, though, I must say. Birds are singing. There's a little robin feeding its chicks in the back garden here. They just fledged recently. Yeah, lovely day.
And just to remind people, we're actually recording this programme. So if you look out your window and you live in Greystone, you say, hey, it's not raining here. What's he talking about? This is a pre-recorded programme as a result of the COVID-19 cocooning. So, Richard, I'm going to start with you today, and you're going to find this fascinating, Niall, and you two at home. And to join in, you may have to log on to the website right now or a little bit later on, rte.ie/Mooney. We've been playing a lot of videos from our listeners in the past few weeks, and I've been making some home movies myself. And I made another one this week of a mute swan with her cygnet in Blessington Basin. Have a listen. Well, here I am in Blessington Basin, and what a lovely treat it is to see an adult mute swan with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 baby swans, or cygnets as they're known. But anyway, as you can see, they are not white. Far from it, they are grey. Lovely, fluffy, downy grey, which makes them so appealing. You just want to take them home with you, but you can't. And they look gorgeous now. This could well be their first swim. And if it is, then it means, as I understand it, from everything I've learned from Richard over the years, he is our expert on mute swans, that this is their second day. Am I right, Richard? We'll find out in just a moment. And what's happening right now is these cygnets are imprinting on the parent. And it's vital at this stage for the parent to make sure that nothing else comes between her, him, and them. Because they're very, very vulnerable. They will latch on to anything at the very early stages. So he, she, the adult, is preening away there, as you can see. And it probably is the female, because she would have been absolutely wasted after that long incubation of about a month or so. So she's getting herself back in trim and in shape. You can see she looks a bit emaciated, so it probably is the female. And at any rate, as I was saying, these mute swans will imprint on anything at this stage. So if I was to walk by them and they were to latch onto me, they'd be little moonies, not little swans. I'm serious. I'll get Richard to explain all about that in just a moment. But I just wanted to record it on my phone so we can show it to you at home and you can have a look at 6 cygnets and an adult on their maiden voyage, exploring the world for the first time. Isn't it wonderful? Richard Collins is our expert on mute swans. Richard, I'll start with you. So is it a bevy of swans? What would you say?
Well, I would say a family of swans at this stage. There are all sorts of names everywhere. For the large group of adult swans, it's called a herd. It dates from the time when swans were a kind of a farm animal. They were herded into pits and eaten at festivals and things like that. But I would say a family of swans. It's a beautiful one. Where did you film that, Derek?
Blessington Basin, Richard. And you can see on the video there, because it really is wonderful, the 6 baby swans are kind of following the mother very closely. I was theorising that this is their first swim. Could I be right, do you think, looking at that video?
Yes, you could be right. When the eggs come up to, they're very democratic, swans are. Everybody gets the same chance in life, unlike things like falcons and hawks and things, where there's an inchik who gets all the attention and then the next one 2 days later hatches. All the swans hatch together. And they're all inside the eggs, and they hear each other seeping and tipping on the eggs, and they all come out together. They do that over about 24 hours usually. Sometimes the odd one takes a bit longer. And she sits there waiting for them all to come out. And when they're all out, then she very quickly, within a day, she will proceed, usually, there's nothing written in stone here, she will proceed onto the water, and they will meet their father for the first time. And he will start to bond with them. She's been bonded by all the little squeaks and movements under her. She's bonded with them. She is a mother to them. He has now to become a father to them. Now, the only main exception to that is if there's an egg or two that didn't hatch, she'll linger on the nest, hoping, well, not hoping in our sense, but expecting that the egg will hatch, you see. So that would delay things a bit. But if there's no egg in the nest, she's out there 24 to 48 hours. They're out on the water for their first swim. Now, they look vulnerable, that they wouldn't be waterproof, but actually they are their little downy feathers are remarkably waterproof, but they are vulnerable to cold. So for the next few nights she will be brooding them. She will put them under her at night to keep them warm. So that's the pattern.
It's important for her to get them out onto the water as soon as possible. I mean, that's going to be their domain.
Yes, indeed. She has the big problem now is to get them to a place where they can feed. Swans don't pick up food and put it in the babies' mouths. They take them to some place where there is suitable food and expect them to get on with it. Now, the babies are very well equipped. They have a lot of fat on board. Now, the yolk of the egg, about a third of that, is still in the body cavity of the chicks. This is there to give them about a week, up to a week's security, in case the weather is terrible and they can't feed, as storms and rain and everything like that. So, and they have to learn to feed. So they have on board this reserve supply of yolk in the body cavity, which will tide them over until they master those skills. There was one strange case where it went to 10 days, I remember, in Britain. Baby swans couldn't feed due to a defect, and they lasted 10 days before they died. So, but it's a very interesting conundrum. So now they will be swimming around with their parents. The parents mind them, they're very careful, and they have a couple of little calls and things which mean various things to swans. The babies have about four different calls. So they communicate with each other and with their mother, and she communicates with them.
And as I mentioned there, they're imprinting at this stage, aren't they? That's really a crucial time in their lives, these first few days, so that they don't imprint on people like me walking by and become little moonies. As I said, people might think I'm a bit mad saying that, but that does happen, doesn't it?
Oh, that does happen. The imprinting is a most strange form of learning. I mean, it's a more weird thing. We probably do it ourselves in infancy as well. We become imprinted on our parents and so on. But as it peaks, when they're very small, they don't imprint. At about the optimum time for waterfowl is around 13 to 16 hours. That's the optimal period when imprinting is strongest. But the extraordinary thing about imprinting, well, there are several extraordinary things, but one of the extraordinary things is that it is very hard to eradicate once it's there. And it's gone by day 28 in wildfowl. They can't be imprinted beyond that, or so their research seemed to indicate. So for a very brief period, they pick up the form and sounds of the biggest object near them, moving object, which generally is the mother duck or the mother goose or the mother swan. And they then, when they come to maturity, they seek out that that sort of thing to breed with. And if they get imprinted on a tin box or something, they'll look for tin boxes when they get old.
Because we saw this with the trumpeter swans that are brought from Alaska into North America. Remember, they were hunted out of North America, almost extinct down to the last few. And then a program was initiated. Tell us a little bit about that and why imprinting is so important.
Yeah, that was early Virginia, the time we went over for a most fascinating week we spent there with swan experts from all over the world were there at that time, and we interviewed many of them. But the idea there was that they had to raise young trumpeters. They take the eggs from nests. The trouble with the swans is that the migrant swans have to teach their babies the migration route. And if they don't get this tuition, if they don't go to school and learn the migration route, they won't know where to go. So in the early days, they wanted to restore trumpeters to areas further south in the United States. So they simply took eggs, hatched them, and released the babies. But the babies flew in all directions. They didn't know what way to go. So to overcome this, they devised this method by which...
Microlite,
that's what they were called. They, first of all, they got ladies to dress up in white outfits as if they were swans. And they raised them with these swan mums, I think they call them.
Yeah, so as soon as the chicks hatched out of the eggs, the first thing they saw were these swan mums and these white, what looked like motor racing suits, and they wore helmets, and they were all white. So the bird identified with that form and followed those ladies around. So did everything they did, and those ladies fed them, and then they took into the air.
Then the microlight came in. The idea was to take the swans out behind the little plane and fly them around and get them used to flying behind the plane. And then the plane would fly stage all the way back northwards to the Canadian border where they wanted the swans to go in, on migration, landing every night after 100 miles or so and penning the swans for the night and then flying on the next day all the way up until they had learned the route back, their traditional route back to the Canadian border. That was the theory behind it. It had been done with geese, and the geese were very good at this. The swans actually proved less good because they were a bit balshy. They used to get into rows about who should go first and things like that. And the odd one would sulk and fly off, and the microlife would have to land and retrieve.
Yes, but it shows the importance of imprinting, which is what we're talking about in relation to the swans in Blessington's Basin. I mean, it clearly shows that imprinting works.
Yes, indeed it does. I remember, this is a red herring in a way, I suppose, but I remember in Africa being with this guy who looking at herds of zebra and wildebeests and things of this kind. And he told me that the zebra has its stripes imprint on its baby. The mother will leave the herd and drop her foal in long grass and vegetation. And then she will walk around the baby. And that baby then looking up becomes imprinted on that pattern of stripes. So that when she takes the baby back into the herd, as she does soon after birth, the baby then can recognize...
So it's like a barcode almost.
Like a barcode, exactly like that. Now, this has stayed with me. That must be 30 years ago that this fellow told me this. But I was very impressed at the time. And all the zebras had a unique code. Well, I put that to various zookeepers and fellows who deal with zebras. But I've never got anyone who would either affirm it or deny it. But it is said by this guy in Africa, who should know his stuff, he was a South African wildlife man, he said that zebra become imprinted on their mother in this way.
On the stripes, that's extraordinary, isn't it? Niall Hatch, you want to say something?
Yes, I find that the whole thing about the zebra is really fascinating. I know there was some research done recently on what other benefits those stripes give them, and it's really interesting. It was long thought that it was may have been an adaptation for camouflage, and you might think, well, how would it camouflage them? They're black and white, they stick out in the savannah, you'd see them very obviously, until you realise that the predators, like the lions and the leopards and so on, that go after them, they are colourblind. They can't see colours, so they blend in much better to their surroundings than they would to human eyes. But actually, it seems even more so than that, seems the main reason for those stripes is that they deter flies. They've done some experiments and they've shown that the actual patterning of the black and white on the bodies of the zebras, it makes it more likely that those biting flies will avoid them. So they did experiments with horses and painting horses and donkeys and so on, and found that the ones that had black and white stripes on them meant that they were less susceptible to fly bite. So it's very interesting how this pattern seems to have evolved for different reasons in that species. Fascinating as well hearing about the swans. Mute swans are absolutely wonderful birds. This is one of my favourite times of year because the little cygnets are out. Unfortunately, because of the COVID-19 restrictions, I can't get near anywhere where there are swans at the moment to see them. But I always thought it was very unfair, really, that the mute swan cygnet was the inspiration for the ugly duckling in the story, because I think they're anything but ugly. I think they're extremely cute, adorable little things.
They're beautiful. You want to take them home, as I said in the video, Richard.
Of course, the ugliness, so-called, has a function, because the daddy swan would resist white chicks because he drives white chicks out. He is very territorial. He is, and he doesn't tolerate white birds on his domain. And you often find things like Aylesbury ducks being harassed and so forth. So by being a grey, dirty brown, and the cygnets become grey, browny thing, this disables the aggression in the father, and he tolerates his own family. But when they start to turn white, January, February following, he begins to be increasingly unhappy with their presence. And eventually, if they don't go, he will drive them out. He will actually attack them and drive them out. He has to do this because his wife has to farm eggs and he hatch a new clutch. And if he doesn't drive them out, there won't be enough water, weed and food for them to survive the next breeding season. So it makes sense.
I have to say, looking at her on the water, because, and you hear a lot of sound in the background of that video, it's because there are two water features there. She looked a little bit knackered. Can I use that term? I mean, if she had been sitting on those eggs for the last month or so, she would be knackered. So she was preening herself quite vigorously.
Oh, yes. 36 days of incubation, and she doesn't feed at all, mostly, in that time. She's relying on her fats. She just gets on that nest, puts a head under the wing, and sleeps on right through. On the little island in the middle of Blessington, that's where the Blessed Industry Basin, that's where they used to nest. When I used to take a canoe there and go out to the nest and count the eggs and ring the parents and the cygnets in due course. So I know this. I'm one of the privileged few who've been out to the little island in Blessington Street Basin. But there, Blessington Street is a wonderful place to be a small baby swan. It's not such a good place when they get to maturity. The reason is that it's surrounded by high buildings, and the poor old swans have to take off the day their father drives them out. They have to take off and clear those buildings, and they don't have the benefit of wind because it's too sheltered. And over the years, a lot of them came to grief colliding with buildings around there and landing on the road. And imagine it, a baby swan living in this nice comfortable area with people throwing them bread and everything every day. Suddenly it clears the buildings, and what does it see? A forest of television aerials and roofs as far as the eye can see. It must be an awful shock for poor business.
Well, when you put it like that, it sounds quite shocking to me too. I've never noticed it. It's Dublin's best kept secret, Blessington Basin. There's no question about it. The water was used for the distilleries, Jameson Distilleries, I understand it. For
I believe it was the Jameson Distillery that used to take the water from there. And yeah, as you said, it really is a well kept secret. A lot of people don't realise it's tucked away there in the middle of all those buildings, as Richard said. But it's actually a great place for birds. There are many different species of duck in there in addition to the swans. And it's a great place to take a stroll. It's nice and compact, and yeah, great place to be. I'm looking forward to getting back there when our movement is opened up and we can travel a bit further.
Niall, do you remember the eggshell I found in my garden?
Yes, I do. Absolutely. Yeah, the white egg, you helpfully measured it using a AA battery so we could get the sense of the size of it. And it looked to me like a collared dove egg.
A collared dove. Well, guess who found a pigeon this morning? Richard Collins, tell us all about it.
Well, I didn't find it. It found me. Barbara and I were awakened at about 4:30 by our cat and this thing crawling around, running around the bed. It turned out to be a young bird, a very young bird. And it is, in fact, when I began to examine it, it has a curious bill. Pigeons have a curious bill when they're small. It was a chick from a wood pigeon's nest, totally uninjured. I have it here, and we have been feeding it. Barbara, my wife, has been nurse to this little fellow. Now, looking at it, it is about, I reckon from the weight, it's about 103 grams, and looking at the chart for the weights of baby pigeons, that puts it to about 7 to 8 days old. Now, interesting thing about pigeons, the funny beak, I think, is there so that the little baby can reach into its parent's crop. Pigeons feed their babies on milk, special milk they create.
It's like porridge, isn't it, as I understand it?
I've never tasted it.
Well, I mean, it's the consistency. I don't know about the taste. The consistency, it's not like other milk.
It's not. But anyway, in order to get the head in and down into the crop, the bill is is slightly decurved, but it drinks this. When it's very small, it's about 94-95%. At this stage, it's about 3/4 of its food is milk. Then gradually, as it goes on, it weans up. The reason for that is that pigeons have hit on a different way of feeding young. If you're a finch or a bunting or something like that, come the spring, you can't feed your babies on things like seeds and fruits and things. You need high-protein food, you see. So a seed-eating bird has to change its entire way of life and go off catching caterpillars and flies and butterflies and moths and God knows what, beetles and everything, to feed to its baby. That's a thing it doesn't do the rest of the time because it's a seed eater. Now, the pigeons have a similar kind of problem. They are vegetarians, so they opted for a different route. They said, well, we won't change our lifestyle. We'll continue feeding on vegetation and farmers' fields and things like that, and we will manufacture milk, and the milk will feed the babies. So this is an interesting, and flamingos do the same, it is an interesting diversion to create milk.
And both the male and the female produce the milk.
They do,
pigeons, as I understand it.
They both produce the milk, but the problem is they can't.
Is that unusual?
It is unusual. The flamingos do that as well. It's a way of dealing with feeding babies, which evolved to help their lifestyle so that the parents wouldn't have to change their lifestyle too much. It has its drawbacks, you see, because you're a flying bird. Mm-hmm. That means you can't have large breasts and things full of milk like a mammal can, because a mammal doesn't have to worry because she is on the ground. She's not flying around, you see. But the pigeon can't develop vast quantities of storage systems or tanks for milk. So the result is that it can only afford to have one or two chicks in the nest. So it limits the reproductive power of the pigeon. If you take something like a blue tit, it'll produce a dozen or more youngsters. Pigeon two at a time.
Well, I'm talking about the feral pigeons now, is what I was reading about. And I read that they could literally have two in the nest, and they could have two eggs and be incubating another nest and be thinking about the next crop after that.
They could. I mean, if they, in very good conditions, I suppose they could. Feral pigeons are almost a domesticated bird. They're not really a natural wild species anymore. They're derived from a wild ancestor called the rock dove, which you still find in some of the more remote parts of the west of Ireland, on some sea cliffs and on some islands. And they're very shy birds, and they tend to avoid people completely. But it was also one of the first species to be domesticated in Europe, and it was kept for its eggs and for its meat to begin with. And then also they had this homing ability, so they could be used to carry messages from one place to another, to bring them back home from places like the battlefield, which, as an aside, is quite interesting because it's not a migratory species, so we don't know why they have such a strong homing instinct. But anyway, they were bred in captivity and would have been selectively bred to produce more chicks faster than other species would. And over time, this would have been selected for by people. They would have more chicks, in the same way that domestic chickens have been bred to lay more eggs than they naturally would in the wild. And it's the same thing. So that sort of human selective pressure may still be having an effect on the breeding abilities of now that these feral pigeons that have gone wild again and have gone back into live in our cities. They're sort of all the different breeds of domestic pigeons sort of mixed back together to produce this feral pigeon that we all know from our city streets. So their breeding ability is probably a bit above what it would be in a truly natural wild state. That's true.
Can either of you answer this? Because I've been looking at feral pigeons quite a lot lately. When you're out walking and you're in the park and all that kind of stuff, you see a lot of them, and the courtship behaviour is obvious and evident for everybody to see, even if they're not quite sure what's going on. But I heard that pigeons actually kiss each other. Is that true? Richard, have you ever heard that? Niall, have you ever heard that?
Well, you will get birds doing what we call mutual preening. And I've seen pigeons do this myself. And what they do is it's a way to strengthen this pair bond in some species. Probably the best known for this would be the lovebirds, these parrots, which obviously aren't native to Ireland, but they're kept in captivity as pets by some people. And they would often sit together on the perch and they preen each other's feathers. This is a way to show that they're a couple, to show that they're strengthening this flock bond, or this pair bond between them, which it seems makes them more likely right to carry out their parental duties as well. It gives this bond means that they're likely to be better parents. And you will see pigeons doing that. With other species too, you get courtship feeding, including with some birds of prey and with many seabirds as well, where one of the pair, usually the male, feeds the female. And this again is a way to strengthen this pair bond. So I suppose in many senses, human kissing performs the same sort of function. It's all about evolution and reproduction, really.
Yeah, it's about getting people interested. I'm told the courtship ritual, he sees her, he kind of does a little bit of circular dance. He's nodding the head, she's nodding the head. He shows her the fan tail, he shows what he's got. She eventually shows her fan tail, and then they kind of come together and they kind of put their beaks together and it's like a kiss. That's what I was told. I don't know if that's true or not. I'm only throwing it out there. I mean, people will be noticing these kind of things in the park. Listen, are we giving out mixed messages here, Niall? Because last week when Janet and her son Jaden, who live in Clane, sent in the video of their little bird, the sparrow, which the cat had brought in, you were saying to them, don't try to feed it, put it back and leave it alone. Now, Richard, on the other hand, his cat brings in a wood pigeon and he's looking after it. He's mammying it. What should he be doing?
Well, my advice remains the same. It would always be to where possible, to return the chick to its parents. It gives it the best possible chance of survival. And in many cases, particularly with small songbirds like sparrows, which are quite different to pigeons, in many cases, it's very hard for them to survive unless their parents are feeding them. People try their best to feed them, but they tend to treat them almost like human babies and don't feed them anywhere near enough. Birds need to be fed every few minutes, really. And their parents instinctively know exactly what kind of food to give them. With pigeons, it's a little bit easier because they drink this milky substance, as we described, and they're gradually weaned onto more of a solid diet. So it's a bit clearer what they should be fed. And obviously, Richard is very skilled and knows what he's doing. But by and large, it's very important that the birds are reunited with their parents as soon as possible, because they often will end up malnourished. There's a problem with imprinting, as we talked about earlier, in relation to the swans. They might imprint on the wrong species. And certainly when it comes to songbirds, so birds that learn their songs. So pigeons don't do that. We're talking a couple of weeks ago on the programme about how some birds have their songs genetically coded into their brains. So pigeons and cuckoos are like that. They never have to learn them. But most of our songbirds, in fact, all of the songbirds we have in Ireland, they have to learn their songs from their parents, from their father, usually. And if a bird, usually from the age of between 8 to about 12 days, depends on the species, if they're not exposed to a male of their species singing the correct song, they'll never learn how to sing correctly. So the males will sing a wonky song that won't be attractive to the females, and the females won't know what song to listen out for in a potential mate. So the chances of actually breeding, if they do survive, the chance of actually reproducing would be extremely low. So in many cases, hand-rearing birds, it's not something we would recommend unless someone really knows what they're doing and is trained in it. In almost all cases, the best thing is to pop them back in the nest if they're very small, or to leave them with their parents if they're that bit older. And another thing, of course, is that this bird is a very young one that Richard is looking after, and it definitely clearly needs help if it can't go back to its parents. Most of the cases, though, when people find young birds in their garden, they think they've been orphaned or abandoned, but in most cases it's quite normal for them to have left the nest before they're able to fly, and their parents are still looking after them, they're still feeding them. They tend not to be too frightened of people. They've never really encountered us before. That instinct hasn't kicked in, so they'll just sit there. Sometimes they'll let people pick them up, and people take this as thinking that they need help. But in most cases, these birds aren't abandoned, they aren't orphaned, the parents are still looking after them, and it's best to just let them get about the business of feeding them and carry on.
Niall, I want to ask you about the wind we had in the past couple of days. I don't mean personally, you understand, but I noticed that the trees at my back, and I put a little video on the website rte.ie/Mooney for everybody to see, but it was quite strong, and I was thinking, how could a nest possibly cling to the branches when the wind is blowing the way it was blowing?
It's certainly a windy day, Derek, and when that happens at this time of year, unfortunately, it can sometimes lead to nests blowing out of trees and bushes. I think I'm going to blow over myself. It is quite blustery. But what's happening is that sometimes, especially birds in their first year when they're nesting, they're not as experienced as older birds would be, and sometimes they can nest in inappropriate or poorly chosen locations. And when that happens, sometimes the nests are quite vulnerable to the elements, and particularly to heavy wind, especially if it comes in a big gust after a period of time when it's been quite calm. The birds haven't been expecting it. In most cases, though, nests are very solidly constructed and tend to stay very well situated and lodged in the trees and bushes where they are. Most birds will choose as secluded a spot as possible. And birds like robins, for example, and blackbirds that would nest in hedges and bushes, they'll tuck the nest in as deep as they can, and they'll try to have a bit of cover or shelter in front of it so that if a heavy wind or a heavy rain indeed comes along, it won't blow right into the nest and will keep it safe. For birds like blue tits that nest inside cavities, they're obviously much safer again, because it would be almost impossible for one of their nests to actually physically blow out of a cavity like that. So it's even easier again for them, and that's one of the big advantages of nesting inside a cavity. Some of the nests, particularly those of pigeons and doves, they tend to be flimsier. They're just sort of a platform of sticks that aren't really held together very well. And if they get a gust of wind, sometimes they can be blown right out of the bush or the tree where they're nesting. So we tend to see it more with pigeons and doves than we do with other species. But that said, it is quite rare. If people do find a nest on the ground and the eggs are intact or the chicks are uninjured, just the best thing of all to do is just pop the nest back up, ideally into the original location if you can find where that was, if you know where it was. But if not, putting it high off the ground, deep inside a bush, where the chicks can continue to call and their parents will hopefully hear them and will continue to feed them. There's no guarantee that'll happen, but it often does. In most cases, the birds are very good at building the nests, and it generally is quite safe. They're actually able to withstand surprisingly tough conditions.
Well, thank you for that, Niall. Anyway, we've had some audio sent in by Liam Loftus from the Corncrake Conservation Project. If you've been listening to the Dawn Chorus in the past couple of years, you will know that when we started the broadcast just after midnight, the first bird we were hearing sing was the corncrake. Well, we didn't have a live Dawn Chorus this year, so we had no corncrake. But I'm glad to say the corncrakes are alive and well. Here's Liam's report.
And there they are. There's several males calling here at Borhov in Belmullet. I'm just on the Mullet Peninsula tonight and starting my census down the peninsula. So they've just started up really in the last half hour. It's gotten dark now. The winds are still up, but they're dropping a little later, so it should get calmer. It's been raining on and off for most of the day. It's cleared up, so there should be food for them today, and they're really calling. So this area here is one of the largest early cover plots in the country. It's about 7 hectares, and at the moment there's 7 males calling here. The first one was confirmed here, our first one was calling here around the 22nd of April and was confirmed breeding about a week later. This is good numbers for early in the season. Our census just began this week, so the field workers normally go out for the next 2.5 months. We'll go out any nights where the conditions are good enough to hear the corncrakes. We'll be usually out from about midnight to 3 in the morning. I'll cover the Mullet Peninsula, North Mayo, and any other reports outside of Mayo for West Connacht. So at the moment the numbers are pretty good on the Mullet Peninsula. We have a few other areas to check out tonight. We're almost up at last year's numbers, and it's very early in the season, so the growth rate has been pretty good this year, and the weather was a lot warmer for April than last year, so that's definitely helped. There's nothing to disturb them here in this early cover every year, so come April the sheep and horses that graze here in the winter are taken out, stock is taken out, and the area is fenced, and so when the birds arrive in, there's enough space for them here where they don't have to compete. There's good food source here in the nettles, and they'll pretty much call here for the entire breeding season. I can hear one about 1 kilometer away in the distance as well, and that was just arrived today, so I'll be making my way over that direction in a little while.
Thank you, Liam, and if you've any reports of corncrakes where you live, you might want to send them to Birdwatch Ireland, or you can email mooney@rte.ie. Now, there are almost 3 million motor vehicles in Ireland, more than one for every 2 people, can you believe? Countless nesting birds and their newly fledged chicks are being slaughtered by them on our roads. Barn owls are particularly vulnerable, I'm told, not just during the breeding season, but throughout the year, as they hunt rodents along the road margins. Badgers, foxes, and hares also fall victim to the carnage, but the mammal most at risk is the hedgehog. So writes our own Richard Collins in his column in the Irish Examiner, He goes on to tell us that researchers have now embarked on a study to assess the impact that roads and traffic are having on the UK's native hedgehog population, where it is thought that about 100,000 hedgehogs are killed on roads every year. Earlier, Richard spoke with Lauren Moore. Lauren is a PhD student at the Nottingham Trent University and is lead researcher on the study.
Lauren, you are a researcher into one of our most ancient mammals, the hedgehog. This is a creature that evolved a very long time ago. He was around before dogs and cats appeared on the planet. How long is he around and has he changed much?
It's had quite a wild evolutionary history. It's been around, like you said, for millennia, and it's been relatively unchanged. It's one of the most ancient lineages of the hedgehog and the spiky small mammals that we see around.
It is. It has a funny image, a kind of medieval image. It sort of looks a bit like an awful medieval war instrument or something. And it has a medieval mentality, a siege mentality, or so it would look to an outsider. It rolls into a ball when danger threatens and that sort of thing. Is it a bit intellectually challenged? Is the brain a bit small?
Yes, it has a much smaller brain than many of the animals of its size. They find themselves in all sorts of trouble, whether it's caught in football nets, in ponds, all sorts of places. And like you said, they just roll up into a ball, and that protection helps them against many predators, but not all of them.
Well, now, how well has it fared in recent times? By recent, I mean a century or more, maybe. Is it in decline, and how bad is that decline?
You're right, hedgehogs have shown really significant declines over recent decades. Since the 1950s, it's thought that we've lost 95% of our UK population. And even since the year 2000, we've lost 30% of our hedgehog population in rural, in urban areas, and 50% in our rural areas. So that shows just how rapid the decline is. Habitat loss, in particular, is thought to be a huge driver. In particular, the loss of hedgerows. It might also be the increase in pesticides that reduces their food resources, or getting trapped in football nets, getting caught by grass trimmers. But in particular, a study by the People's Trust for Endangered Species reported that 100,000 hedgehogs are killed every single year on UK roads, and this is felt to be accelerating their decline.
Now, you are embarking on an ambitious programme to help our prickly friend. What does that entail?
It's a really exciting and detailed study. We'll be looking into the risks and the barriers that hedgehogs face when they're moving near our roads. So this will be using nocturnal surveys and genetic analysis to be understanding the proportion of several populations that are killed on our UK roads every single year. But we'll also be going a step further and identifying exactly which individuals, using really exciting GPS methods to monitor their movements and how often they cross roads. But we'll also be looking into the use of road tunnels and whether these are an effective conservation measures for the species. For example, do hedgehogs use these tunnels at all? And if they do, how many? And is it enough to combat the roadkill? And in particular, what features can we use to enhance the use of these road tunnels by hedgehogs?
Is there much research you can draw on from Ireland? Ireland is very like Britain, particularly as far as roads are concerned, so it should be relevant.
Yes, in fact, a huge amount of our own project is inspired by some of the work that has been on hedgehogs and roads in Ireland. Some fantastic work has been done on the road between Cork and Galway, counting the number of hedgehog roadkill, but really importantly, identifying which individuals in the population are most at risk. It found that 65% of the roadkilled hedgehogs were male, and this gives us really important insight into the impact of roads on the viability of hedgehog populations.
So the males are running around looking for females at the begin in the breeding season, and they go around like cats do. Tomcats do the same sort of thing. Lots of animals do that. So it's a wandering male seeking gratification from as many females as he can, so he moves a lot. Is that right?
You're exactly right. A male's prerogative is to find as many females as possible. So in general, males will move a lot further than females all throughout the year. But like you said, particularly in breeding season, in May and June, where they can roam up to 2 kilometres in a single night. What's really interesting is that a female is focused on having and rearing the young so that they'll stay nearer the nest and won't cross as many roads until autumn time. At this time, the young are gaining independence, and this allows the females to roam a bit further and find all their food and build their fat reserves for the upcoming hibernation.
Now, there are various kinds of roads. If I were a hedgehog and I wanted to avoid accident on, say, a secondary road or an A road, what would help me to do that? I mean, what possible modifications could there be that would reduce my risk of accident?
So one in particular would be to retrofit road tunnels underneath these really busy roads. And this allows hedgehogs to cross underneath the road without the risk of being caught. So it reduces the number of hedgehogs being killed, but also the habitat connectivity between all of these fragmented habitat patches. So road tunnels are a really promising measure. What we could also do is try to reduce the speed limit around roadkill hotspots, because it allows the driver to have a bit more time to react to a hedgehog if they see it. But it also gives the hedgehog to react as well to the driver if it can. So that's really a feasible, important measure as well.
Do we know for certain that hedgehogs use tunnels under roads?
There's been a fair bit of anecdotal evidence that hedgehogs do use these road tunnels all throughout Europe. Even in the UK, hedgehogs have been caught on camera traps or footprint tunnels. What we don't know is how often and how many hedgehogs use these tunnels. So it's really difficult for us to understand just now if they would be an appropriate mitigation measure for hedgehogs, whether they would be used often enough to combat the roadkill levels that we see.
Can you bribe them into the tunnels by placing food in them at night or something so that they get into the habit of going into the tunnel for food, and then perhaps after the food dries up, they will still continue? Is that a possibility? Are you investigating such a thing?
It's definitely a really interesting idea. And you pick up a really important point with road tunnels for all species, that they must be familiar with the habitat and the landscape, and they must know that the tunnel is there. So what we do, we could put food, but we could also use fences that tend to funnel animals towards the tunnel. So once they try to cross a road, they'll be directed away from the road towards the tunnel, and it gently guides them through. What is particularly interesting is whether the use of badges of these tunnels as well will deter hedgehogs to use them, because badgers are one of the main predators of the hedgehogs, and hedgehogs are known to avoid areas with badger odour.
Badger is an interesting one to raise. Apart from the hedgehog's fear of the badger, a road engineer of my acquaintance told me once, he worked on motorway design here in Ireland, and it is the practice to put in badger tunnels under motorways, and he was putting these in. But apparently one had to be extremely careful to put the tunnel precisely where the badgers have a road. They are very set in their ways and they have a track. They have a particular place where they cross. Now, is that true of hedgehogs? Have they got a road map in their head, a kind of places they're familiar with and routines they follow, so that if you don't put the tunnel in precisely the right place, they won't enter it?
Yes, it's a really big possibility. Hedgehog movement around roads hasn't been investigated as such before, but from our knowledge of movements in the general area, they do have these paths that they tend to follow day in, day out, because they might know where the particular food is or the great resources. So it's very likely that we should put these road tunnels where the crossing frequency is at its greatest.
Is there an optimal design for the tunnel? Do they like wide tunnels, narrow tunnels, winding tunnels, or straight tunnels? And how much would they cost?
So the small amount of data that we have on this shows that hedgehogs tend to prefer more open and wider tunnels, which is quite interesting, actually, considering that they tend to be quite secretive and walk underneath hedges. So they like these more open tunnels, and they prefer them to be nearer urban areas, which makes sense because there's a greater number of hedgehogs in urban areas. Now, these tunnels can be quite costly, thousands of pounds. Some of the overpasses as well might be £1 million, for example. So we do need to be able to have the data to be able to justify building and maintaining these tunnels.
Now, the deliverables at the end of this, are you going to advise road engineers, local authorities, even politicians and the public on this question? Are you going to make recommendations? Do you anticipate to be able to transform the plight of the hedgehog vis-a-vis roads in Britain?
This is really important because an estimated 51% increase in road coverage in the UK is expected by 2050. So we hope to be able to provide some recommendations about the road densities, the road types, and the general layout of roads that might still get us from A to B, but without jeopardising the wildlife populations at the same time.
Lauren, this is an extraordinary project. And apart from the particular questions of roads, you are going to amass an enormous amount of data. I can see a monograph and various works coming out of this. I wish you well with an excellent project, and thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we leave you, I want to tell you about a non-scientific survey which was carried out by Messrs. Mooney and Mooney for this very programme, allowing for acquiescence bias, administration bias and ambiguity. 100% of people surveyed agreed that nature has helped them through the cocooning stage of the coronavirus pandemic. Any psychologist worth their salt will tell you that there is a palpable link between mental health and the environment in which we live. With this in mind, we've asked Carlow-based playwright and novelist John McKenna for his reflections on the landscape in which he lives. John.
Thanks so much, Derek, and thanks for having me on the programme. It's lovely to be with you. And it's lovely particularly to be with you from this gorgeous lane that I'm standing on at the moment. It's very close to the village of Royal Oak in South County Carlow. And I suppose particularly given the situation that we're in at the moment, I'm blessed to have it within 2K and now 5K of where I live. It's a lane that I've walked virtually every day for the past 5 years. I used to take my dog for a walk along the banks of the Barrow, which is not so far from here. And then about 5 winters ago, there was a huge flood and it made it virtually impossible to use the bank. And I also realised, being a bad swimmer, that if it came to any kind of a standoff between the river and myself, there was only going to be one winner. So I set off looking for an alternative route for the dog and myself, and I found this lane. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous walk between fields where at the moment the crops are beginning to grow and where in the autumn they will be harvested. It's a lane that runs along under 100, 150-year-old trees, and it winds its way and it gives at different points different options to take offshoots from it. When I first walked here, it was winter time, so most of the walking was done with my head down into the teeth of a gale. So I didn't see really very much of it other than coming and going. But then I remember the first spring when I walked down along here and I came across a bank of primroses in March, and it suddenly lit up the lane and the possibilities of it for me. And then a couple of weeks later, there were clumps of daffodils, which seemed in the beginning to be growing wild. And then I realised that actually the daffodils were part of a long forgotten garden. And that revealed itself to me as the spring went on. And that in turn led to the remnants of an almost disappeared cottage and the bare outline of what would have been the garden of that cottage. And then the following spring, I just saw this huge bank of lilac trees, absolutely gorgeous. And then the bluebells suddenly appeared in the shadow of a little stand of trees further down the lane, and there was a wild apple tree which budded and bloomed, and in autumn I was able to pick the fruit from that. So that by the end of the first year that I'd spent walking this lane, I had seen all of its colours, and it had begun slowly to reveal some of its history as well. But it took me, I would say, another 2 years of my own investigations and occasionally stopping to have conversations with people who lived on the lane or people that I met on my rambles. And I started to piece together the stories of the people who would have lived here over the centuries. People who were born here, lived here, died here, and were now long gone. I remember coming across a wall, and on closer inspection I realised that actually what had been bricked up in that wall were the remnants of 5 or 6 cottages. And then there's a cul-de-sac which goes off the main lane. There are blackberries growing there in the late summer and all sorts of other fruits available in the beginning of the autumn. But most interestingly, I came across a crumbling farmhouse. And when winter came, suddenly the farmhouse appeared from out of this tangle of branches and brambles. And I remember one afternoon spending an hour just wandering around inside in the ruins of the house while the dog was nosing around on the headland outside. And I started to imagine the ghost voices of generations of the family who had lived there, and they seemed to be kind of whispering stories into my ear. And then each story was lifted and it was blown away by the wind, and I was left only with my imagination to kind of recreate the lives of these people. And right across from that ruined house was a scatter of forget-me-nots, and they in their own turn kind of said to me, listen, you've got to think about the past, you've got to remember the people who lived here. And I got thinking, I remember that day, a beautifully warm, sunny day, and the sun was coming down through the trees. And I suddenly thought, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, the families who lived in this house stood here and they looked at the sun and they probably thought about the turning of the seasons the way I do. They probably wondered at the beauty of the world. They wondered at the way that the world goes on, more or less in spite of us rather than because of us. And so year after year after year, over the last 5 years, there have been different stories and different moments of beauty and sheltered spots in winter and stunning views of the Blackstairs Mountains and the River Barrow in spring. And just last week, I was standing on a headland at the top of one of the fields here, and I was chatting with a man called Joe Summers, who lives in the last house on the lane. And he pointed to a hedge at the other end of the field, and he said that that was where the old mass path had run and that it led down to the river. And then he pointed to the remains of a derelict bridge across the Barrow. And he told me that people would use that as a shortcut from the village of Loughlin Bridge when they were going to mass in Bagnallstown. And it was almost as if, Derek, in that moment, another piece of history was revealed and another choir of voices were telling their stories to me and saying that they deserved to be heard. And it struck me that, as it strikes me now as I'm standing on the lane here, that the landscape around me holds all these stories of people who've lived here in the past and will in time hold stories of people like myself and yourself who are living at the moment.
John, that was absolutely wonderful. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks a million, Derek, and thanks for having me, and I hope that you enjoyed my reflections on the landscape here in South Carlow.
I think there's a series in this. Would you be happy to do some more?
I would absolutely love to. Thank you.
I thought you would. John McKenna, thank you very much indeed. My thanks also to Richard Collins and to Niall Hatch. For more on this programme, all you have to do is visit our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next Sunday at 6 p.m. for Mooney Goes Wild live on RT Radio 1. Goodbye.
And Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.